yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Variety is pretty hard to find on today's airwaves. How about joining the cause to promote alternative variety? TCM 189 is the staff training course for HFCC's own WHFR, a station devoted to new, local, and unique artists. The course provides students with essential station procedures as well as equipment knowledge and basic performance skills. The class can be taken for credit or under the Center for Lifelong Learning. For more information, contact Susan McGraw, WHFR's General Manager at 313-845-9842.
This is the story of a stove.
An energy-saving stove made in Uganda.
When Child Fund worked with local youth to make and sell these stoves, well, things really heated up.
Because these stoves use very little wood and produce less smoke.
Reducing deforestation and respiratory disease.
They're creating jobs and a brighter future.
This is only one of Child Fund's many innovative solutions benefiting children in need worldwide.
To learn more, visit childfund.org.
Child Fund. Innovative solutions, one child at a time.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
If you are a man or a boy, and you have a brother, especially an older brother, and you know that the bond between brothers is unlike any other. Sometimes that bond is almost impossibly wonderful.
We used to, very often, we used to go out and play catch, or one of us would hit the ball with a bat and the other one would catch it. And I remember one time when we were throwing that ball, we were as far apart as we could get and still reach each other with the ball. We were throwing that ball as hard as we could, as far as we could. Of course, the ball was thrown very inaccurately because we were trying so hard to throw it. And so we were making these running, leaping catches. We made more fantastic catches that day than I think we did in all the rest of our years together. That was more fun.
And sometimes the brotherly bond is toxic.
I don't know that it's exactly true that he wanted me to suffer exactly. It's more like, more as if he wanted to score a victory over me, defeat me, put himself in the victorious position and me in the position of one who's defeated and humiliated.
You probably don't recognize this voice because he hasn't spoken much in public. But you do know the person the voice belongs to. It's Ted Kaczynski.
Okay. Do you deny, in the context of this interview, do you deny that you committed the crimes attributed to the Unabomber?
I can't comment on that.
Ted Kaczynski is the Unabomber, a homegrown terrorist who, over the course of 17 years, planted or mailed at least 16 bombs. He killed 3 people and wounded 24. He wasn't a religious fundamentalist, but he was a fundamentalist. His enemy was essentially modern society. He grew up in Chicago, attended Harvard, but he wound up living alone in a remote cabin in the Montana woods. He was arrested in 1996 after one of the most notorious and longest manhunts in history, and he was sentenced to life in prison. How did he finally get caught? His younger brother, David, turned him in.
Were you surprised when you learned that it was David who had turned you in? Were you surprised?
Not terribly surprised.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I interviewed Ted Kaczynski in 1999, 3 years after he was arrested for the crimes that earned him the name the Unabomber. He was in the same prison then as he is today, a federal supermax in Florence, Colorado.
Just in terms of your life in prison again, I'm just wondering a little bit about your daily routine. Do you get 8 hours of sleep a day?
Yeah, usually not all at once.
I had been writing a magazine article about his brother, David, the hero of the Unabomber story, if there was such a thing. Then I learned that Ted was writing a book that wound up never being published. And the book spent most of its time attacking David as intellectually dishonest and resentful of his brilliant big brother. I requested an interview with Ted, even though he didn't do that kind of thing, and to my surprise, he agreed.
The food here, believe it or not, is pretty good.
Yeah.
Sometimes we
talked for several hours. He sat on a concrete bench in a concrete room, a wall of reinforced glass between us.
I take a shower every other day rather than every day because I have sensitive skin.
Most of our conversation that day was about David and Ted. Ted and David, the brothers Kaczynski. Ted, the older brother by 7 years, intellectually domineering and socially awkward. David, a more tender touch, more adept at living in the real world, but also enthralled to his big brother's love of nature and his hatred of an over-industrialized society. He followed Ted, among other places, into the wilderness. As modern as their story was, it also felt ancient, like Isaac and Ishmael or Greek tragedy. More than anything, it was about the enormous leverage that a big brother can exert on a younger one. Now, I don't mean to say that brotherly love isn't real. It is. And as the youngest of four brothers myself, I've experienced a lot of it. But with brothers, there can be a lot of other stuff, too. Rivalry, resentment, insecurity. There are things that if other people told you to do them, you'd just laugh. Hey, let's set this thing on fire. Or, hey, as soon as it gets dark, let's jump off that cliff. But when your big brother tells you to do this stuff, you do it. Last week's bombings at the Boston Marathon and the violence afterward were apparently, allegedly, committed by a pair of brothers, Tamerlan and Johar Tsarnaev. The older brother has since been killed, the younger brother's under arrest. As we began to learn more about them, I couldn't help but think of the brothers Kaczynski, how the dynamic between brothers is unlike any other. There are some parallels between the two sets of brothers. Johar Tsarnaev, like David Kaczynski, is 7 years younger than his brother. In each case, the older brother was a loner and angry. The younger brother, mellower, better adjusted, and yet they idolized their big brothers. And of course, in each case, there were bombs. But Johar Tsarnaev followed his big brother into violence. David Kaczynski did not. While for many years he and Ted were as close as only brothers can be, there came a time when they were as bitterly estranged as perhaps only brothers can be. The estrangement was a result of David getting a girlfriend. Linda Patrick, whom David had longed for since high school, finally returned his longing. When David and Linda got serious, Ted cut David off. Linda brought David back into the modern world. It was she who persuaded David to consider that his big brother might be the Unabomber and then to go to the FBI. When I interviewed Ted in prison, one stipulation was that he wouldn't talk about his actual crimes since he was still hoping for a retrial. In prison, his neighbors were a who's who of 1990s terrorism. Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber. Ramzi Youssef from the first World Trade Center bombing.
See, there, I'm in a range of cells where there are 8 cells. And this, they call this celebrity row. And these people are not what you would think of as criminal types.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't seem to be very angry people. They're considerate of others. Some of them are quite intelligent.
Listening back to this conversation from nearly 15 years ago, I'm reminded of two things, two disturbing things. One, that Ted Kaczynski doesn't sound like the kind of angry, antisocial person who would run around killing people, or at least how we think that kind of person should sound. And two, as you're about to hear, that Ted has such a deep reservoir of disdain for David that he makes it sound as if David, the man who stopped the bombings, is the bad guy, because he, David, hadn't stayed the course, because he hadn't stayed loyal to his big brother.
Is it fair to say that your relationship with David over the years, which obviously had a lot of peaks and valleys, is it fair to say that that was the most profound personal relationship you'd ever had?
I would say it's the deepest personal relationship that I ever had. Between my teens and about 1990, when I finally broke off with him.
Right. In terms of you and David, how do you think that you two are most alike?
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
Over many years, we shared a great many values.
Right.
And it's not clear to me to what extent this was simple imitation of me on his part. And if it was simple imitation on his part, you wouldn't really call it a similarity.
Right.
But there's some similarities apart from that. I think we're both basically quiet, somewhat introverted types, both a little on the shy side. Another similarity between us would be that, generally speaking, I think he's a very honest person.
You wrote that his adulation of you disgusted you at certain points over the course of your relationship.
Yeah.
Did you try to communicate that to him? Did you say to him, Dave, this is not a healthy way to be. I'm glad you like me.
Yeah.
I'm glad you respect me, but be your own person. Did you ever try to have that kind of conversation with him?
No.
Why not? I mean,
and it would have been very painful to him to have me say that. And it probably wouldn't have done any good.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I could, in one way or another, he would appear to be overvaluing me, but it wasn't something that was so explicit that I could be sure that it was really that.
Right. In your dreams, literally in your dreams and in your thinking, it sounds as you really felt protective of David for many, many years, yes?
Yeah.
Do you think at some point that he ever began to feel protective of you? Do you think that as he moved into adulthood, especially after you had cut off communication, do you think that he ever began to feel protective of you?
No.
You don't? In what ways, if any, do you think he was jealous of you?
He's probably jealous of the fact that I got more attention from my former parents. He was jealous of the fact that simply that I was dominant in our relationship. Jealous of the fact that I was smarter than he was. I could do most things better than he could. Athletics are one exception.
In what ways, if any, were you jealous of Dave?
The only way I can think that I might have been somewhat jealous of him was that when he was in high school, he always had lots of friends. He was socially successful, and I wasn't. And I may have had some jealousy about that,
yeah.
Though I don't clearly remember that.
When we come back, how Ted Kaczynski went even further into the path of radicalism, and how his adoring little brother finally found his way back into the mainstream.
What do you regret most in retrospect about your relationship with David, about the way the relationship devolved, I guess?
Well, I'd say basically that I didn't break off with him 20 years earlier.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Mozy Cloud Backup by EMC, helping over 80,000 businesses back up their business files to the cloud and offering access across smartphones, tablets, and laptops. Mozy has backup plans for businesses of all sizes, ranging from home offices to companies with a dedicated IT staff. More information at mozy.com. Use promo code FREAKY at checkout for a special offer. Mozy, it's always there. Freakonomics Radio is supported by Stamps.com, where users can buy and print official U.S. postage from their own computer and printer without going to the post office or leasing a postage meter. Stamps.com provides a digital scale that automatically calculates the exact postage needed for any letter or package. Freakonomics listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, digital scale, and free postage. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter code FREAK.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today's episode is from a prison interview I did nearly 15 years ago with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, for an article that was published in Time magazine. I dug up the old tapes this week because the brothers charged with the Boston Marathon bombings reminded me of the strange, volatile dynamic of brotherhood, especially the pull of a big brother on a younger one. For years, David Kaczynski identified with his older brother's antisocial worldview.
I mean, he was certainly alienated from the mainstream system of values. He just particularly hated Reagan and that whole political bunch. And yet, I wouldn't say exactly he had sympathy for Hinckley or for radicals generally. And there was resentment there, and yet there was never any hope or ambition on his part to actually do anything active or take radical measures.
In other words, as Ted Kaczynski sees it, his younger brother David wasn't radical enough to be taken seriously. And then, even worse, he went totally mainstream. He got married to a woman named Linda Patrick, who found Ted creepy, maybe even dangerous. David tried to keep up his relationship with Ted, writing long, heartfelt letters. But eventually, Ted shut him out.
What do you regret most in retrospect about your relationship with David, about the way the relationship devolved, I guess?
Well, I'd say basically that I didn't break off with him 20 years earlier.
So you still feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of satisfaction out of corresponding with him. I mean, it was a good relationship. It was in many respects, not all respects, but in many respects, a positive relationship from my point of view.
Right.
But I don't think it was from my brother's point of view. And in the end, it turned out to be disastrous from my point of view, as you can see.
Right. What do you think would have changed in his life if you had broken off earlier?
Well, I mean, let me put it this way. I think that his sense of rivalry with Big Brother, his attempt to equal Big Brother and to win Big Brother's approval with very limited success. I think all this was very hard on him. I think that his self-esteem would have been in much better shape if he hadn't had me to compete with or compare himself with. And I think he would have, and he always had an easy time making friends. He would have had close relationships with other people, so he didn't really need that relationship with me.
Right. If the roles had been reversed, if you had suspected David of being the Unabomber, right? After all the years that you haven't been communicating very regularly, what would you have done?
I would have kept it to myself.
Is that what you feel he should have done?
Yeah.
And what was the first... What was your reaction to that when you first hear that David is involved in turning you in? What does that feel like?
Well, obviously I resented it. There was another strain to my feelings there. I don't know if I can explain it properly, but in a way I was almost glad because my own brother turning me in a sense, made me feel good.
How so?
Well, I mean, it's...
That you had eluded everyone but someone who knew you close.
Well, I didn't say I eluded anyone for anything. I mean, I pled guilty, but that was because I was forced to do so. But it was that... I mean... If A screws B, then it tends to make B look good, even if otherwise he might not look so great. I don't know.
Right.
So maybe that was perhaps an ignoble thought on my part, but that thought was present, I have to admit.
Okay.
When Ted was arrested, David fought hard to keep him from getting the death penalty. This made Ted angry. He wanted the death penalty. So where the rest of the world sees David Kaczynski turning in his older brother as an act of heroism, Ted sees resentment. And where the rest of us see David pleading for his brother's life as an act of mercy, Ted sees it as further punishment.
I'm not depressed or downcast. Let's see if I can explain this. There's sort of different levels of how you feel about your life. Let me try to explain it this way. When I was living in the woods, there was sort of an undertone, an underlying feeling that things were basically right with my life. That is, something might go wrong, I might have a bad day, I might screw something up, I might break my axe handle and do something else, and everything would go wrong, but still, somehow, underneath the superficial unhappiness or bad feelings, it was an underlying feeling that my life was right. I was able to fall back on the fact that here I was, a free man in the mountains, surrounded by forests and wild animals and so forth. And this made my life right, even if things were, for the time being, going badly. Here it's the other way around. I'm not depressed or downcast, and I have things to do that I consider productive, like working on getting this book out. And yet, the knowledge that I'm locked up here and likely to remain so for the rest of my life is... it ruins it. It's the undertone in this case is an extremely bad one, and I don't want to live long. I would rather get the death penalty than spend the rest of my life in prison.
Would you take your own life given the opportunity?
I will not comment on that.
Okay.
I mean, at a superficial level, it isn't really that bad.
Right.
Just the knowledge that I'm locked up and I'm not free, sort of, it's just to me, it's just not a life worth living.
Right. What do you say if you have a retrial and are acquitted and have your life back? What do you say to society to relax them, to not let them worry about the Unabomber is at large?
Well, I don't know that I would have to relax them. Just let them worry.
Okay. If David were to come visit you, if David's in the room now, what do you want to say to him?
Nothing. I just wouldn't talk to him. I just turned my back and wouldn't talk to him.
Yeah. Do you still love him?
No.
We asked David Kaczynski to talk about his brother for this show. He understandably chose not to. Ever since Ted's arrest, David has worked hard to try to repair some of the damage done by his brother. While Ted has never expressed regret or apologized to the victims, David did. He donated money. He toured the country speaking against violence. It's bizarre, to me at least, listening back to this tape of Ted. He makes it sound as if he is the aggrieved party. Can you imagine having an older brother like that who tells you that up is down and down is up? Soon, you might start believing him. And if he has bad intentions, violent intentions, well, you might start believing that those are your intentions too. We don't know enough yet about the Boston bombers to say for sure if Johar, the younger brother, was pulled into his older brother's orbit or whether he followed willingly. But we do know that David Kaczynski didn't do what the younger Tsarnaev brother allegedly did. He didn't join forces. He didn't capitulate. He didn't run to do evil. This episode has been talk, all talk, about actions, terrible actions. Talk may be interesting, but let's be clear. It's our actions that matter. All this talk offers no solace whatsoever to the victims of Ted Kaczynski, to the victims of the criminals in Boston. I wish we could do better. But at this moment, words are all we have.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Catherine Wells, David Herman, Bere Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Once upon a time, there was a place called Lesterland. Now, Lesterland looks a lot like the United States. Like the United States, it has about 311 million people, and of that 311 million people, it turns out 144,000 are called Lester. If Matt's in the audience, I just borrowed that. I'll return it in a second, this character from your series. So 144,000 are called Lester, which means about 0.05% is named Lester. Now, Lesters and Lesterland have this extraordinary power. There are two elections every election cycle in Lesterland. One is called the general election. The other is called the Lester election. And in the general election, it's the citizens who get to vote, but in the Lester election, it's the Lesters who get to vote. And here's the trick. In order to run in the general election, you must do extremely well in the Lester election. You don't necessarily have to win, but you must do extremely well. Now, what can we say about democracy in Lesterland? Well, we can say, number one, as the Supreme Court said in Citizens United, the people have the ultimate influence over elected officials, because after all, there is a general election. But only after the Lesters have had their way with the candidates who wish to run in the general election. And number two, obviously, this dependence upon the Lesters is going to produce a subtle, understated, we could say camouflaged, bending to keep the Lesters happy. Okay, so we have a democracy, no doubt, But it's dependent upon the Lesters and dependent upon the people. It has a competing dependencies, we could say conflicting dependencies, depending upon who the Lesters are. Okay, that's Lesterland. Now, there are three things I want you to see now that I've described Lesterland. Number one, the United States is Lesterland. The United States is Lesterland. The United States also looks like this, also has two elections. One we call the general election. The second we should call the money election. In the general election, it's the citizens who get to vote if you're over 18, in some states if you have an ID. In the money election, it's the funders who get to vote. The funders who get to vote. And just like in Lesterland, the trick is to run in the general election, you must do extremely well. In the money election, you don't necessarily have to win. There is Jerry Brown, but you must do extremely well. And here's the key. There are just as few relevant funders in USA land as there are Lesters in Lesterland. Now you say, really? Really? 0.05%? Well, here are the numbers from 2010. 0.26% of America gave $200 or more to any federal candidate. 0.05% gave the maximum amount to any federal candidate. 0.01%, the 1% of the 1%, gave $10,000 or more to federal candidates. And in this election cycle, my favorite statistic is 0.000042%. For those of you doing the numbers, you know that's 132 Americans gave 60% of the super PAC money spent in the cycle we have just seen ending. So I'm just a lawyer. I look at this range of numbers, and I say it's fair for me to say it's 0.05% who are irrelevant funders in America. In this sense, the funders are our Lesters. Now, what can we say about this democracy in USA land? Well, as the Supreme Court said in Citizens United, we could say, of course, the people have the ultimate influence over the elected officials. We have a general election, but only after the funders have had their way with the candidates who wish to run in that general election. And number two, obviously, this dependence upon the funders produces a subtle, understated, camouflaged bending to keep the funders happy. Candidates for Congress and members of Congress spend between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to get back to Congress or to get their party back into power. And the question we need to ask is, what does it do to them, these humans, as they spend their time behind the telephone calling people they've never met, but calling the tiniest slice of the 1%? As anyone would, as they do this, they develop a sixth sense, a constant awareness about how what they do might affect their ability to raise money. They become, in the words of the X-Files, shapeshifters, as they constantly adjust their views in light of what they know will help them to raise money, not on issues 1 to 10, but on issues 11 to 1,000. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat for Virginia, describes that when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, "always lean to the green." Then to clarify, she went on, "he was not an environmentalist." So here, too, we have a democracy dependent upon the funders and dependent upon the people, competing dependencies, possibly conflicting dependencies, depending upon who the funders are. Okay, the United States is Lesterland, point number one. Here's point number two. The United States is worse than Lesterland. Worse than Lesterland. Because you can imagine in Lesterland, if we Lesters got a letter from the government that said, hey, you get to pick who gets to run in the general election, we would think maybe of a kind of aristocracy of the Lesters. You know, there are Lesters from every part of social society. There are rich Lesters, poor Lesters, black Lesters, white Lesters. Not many women Lesters, but put that to the side one second. We have Lesters from everywhere. We could think, what could we do to make Lesterland better? It's at least possible the Lesters would act for the good of Lesterland. But in our land, in this land, in USA land, there are certainly some sweet Lesters out there, many of them in this room here today, but the vast majority of the Lesters act for the Lesters. Because the shifting coalitions that are comprising the 0.05% are not comprising it for the public interest, it's for their private interest. In this sense, the USA is worse than Lesterland. And finally, point number three. Whatever one wants to say about Lesterland against the background of its history, its traditions, in our land, in USA land, Lesterland is a corruption. A corruption. Now, by corruption, I don't mean brown paper bag cash secreted among members of Congress. I don't mean Rob Blagojevich's sense of corruption. I don't mean any criminal act. The corruption I'm talking about is perfectly legal. It's a corruption relative to the framers' baseline for this republic. The framers gave us what they called a republic. But by a republic, they meant a representative democracy. And by a representative democracy, they meant a government, as Madison put it in Federalist 52, that would have a branch that would be dependent upon the people alone. So here's the model of government. They have the people and the government with this exclusive dependency. But the problem here is that Congress has evolved a different dependence. No longer a dependence upon the people alone, increasingly a dependence upon the funders. Now, this is a dependence too. But it's different and conflicting from a dependence upon the people alone so long as the funders are not the people. This is a corruption. Now, there's good news and bad news about this corruption. One bit of good news is it's bipartisan equal opportunity corruption. It blocks the left on a whole range of issues that we on the left really care about. It blocks the right, too, as it makes principled arguments of the right increasingly impossible. So, the right wants smaller government. When Al Gore was vice president, his team had an idea for deregulating a significant portion of the telecommunications industry. The chief policy man took this idea to Capitol Hill, and as he reported back to me, the response was, "Hell no! If we deregulate these guys, how are we going to raise money from them?" This is a system that's designed to save the status quo, including the status quo of big and invasive government. It works against the left and the right, and that, you might say, is good news. But here's the bad news. It's a pathological, democracy-destroying corruption. Because in any system where the members are dependent upon the tiniest fraction of us for their election, that means the tiniest number of us, the tiniest, tiniest number of us can block reform. I know that should have been like a rock or something. I can only find cheese. I'm sorry. So there it is. Block reform. Because there is an economy here, an economy of influence, an economy with lobbyists at the center, which feeds on polarization. It feeds on dysfunction. The worse that it is for us, the better that it is for this fundraising. Henry David Thoreau, "There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root." This is the root. Okay, now, every single one of you know this. You couldn't be here if you didn't know this, yet you ignore it. You ignore it. This is an impossible problem. You focus on the possible problems, like eradicating polio from the world, or taking an image of every single street across the globe, or building the first real universal translator, or building a fusion factory in your garage. These are the manageable problems, so you ignore... So you ignore this corruption. But we cannot ignore this corruption anymore. We need a government that works. And not works for the left or the right, but works for the left and the right, the citizens of the left and right, because there is no sensible reform possible until we end this corruption. So I want you to take hold, to grab the issue you care the most about. Climate change is mine, but it might be financial reform or a simpler tax system or inequality. Grab that issue, sit it down in front of you, look straight in its eyes and tell it there is no Christmas this year. There will never be a Christmas. We will never get your issue solved until we fix this issue first. So it's not that mine is the most important issue. It's not. Yours is the most important issue. But mine is the first issue, the issue we have to solve before we get to fix the issues you care about. No sensible reform, and we cannot afford a world, a future, with no sensible reform. Okay, so how do we do it? Turns out the analytics here are easy, simple. If the problem is members spending an extraordinary amount of time fundraising from the tiniest slice of America, the solution is to have them spend less time fundraising, but fundraise from a wider slice of America, to spread it out, to spread the funder influence so that we restore the idea of dependence upon the people alone. And to do this does not require a constitutional amendment changing the First Amendment. To do this would require a single statute, a statute establishing what we think of as small-dollar-funded elections, a statute of citizen-funded campaigns. And there are any number of these proposals out there. Fair Elections Now Act, the American Anti-Corruption Act, an idea in my book that I call the Grant and Franklin Project to give vouchers to people to fund elections, an idea of John Sarbanes called the Grassroots Democracy Act. Each of these would fix this corruption by spreading out the influence of funders to all of us. The analytics are easy here. It's the politics that's hard. Indeed, impossibly hard, because this reform would shrink K Street. Shrink K Street. And Capitol Hill, as Congressman Jim Cooper, a Democrat from Tennessee, put it, has become a farm league for K Street. A farm league for K Street. Members and staffers and bureaucrats have an increasingly common business model in their head, business model focused on their life after government, their life as lobbyists. 50% of the Senate between 1998 and 2004 left to become lobbyists, 42% of the House, those numbers have only gone up. And as United Republic calculated last April, the average increase in salary for those who they tracked was 1,452%. So it's fair to ask, how is it possible for them to change this? Now, I get this skepticism. I get this cynicism. I get this sense of impossibility. But I don't buy it. This is a solvable issue. If you think about the issues our parents tried to solve in the 20th century, issues like racism, or sexism, or the issue that we've been fighting in this century, homophobia. Those are hard issues. You don't wake up one day no longer a racist. It takes generations to tear that intuition, that DNA out of the soul of a people. But this is a problem of just incentives. Just incentives. Change the incentives and the behavior changes. And the states that have adopted small-dollar funded systems have seen overnight a change in the practice. When Connecticut adopted this system, in the very first year, 78% of the elected representatives gave up large contributions and took small contributions only. It's solvable. Not by being a Democrat, not by being a Republican. It's solvable by being citizens, by being citizens, by being citizens. Because if you want to kickstart reform, look, I could kickstart reform at half the price of fixing energy policy, I could give you back a republic. Okay, but even if you're not yet with me, even if you believe this is impossible, what the 5 years since I spoke at TED has taught me as I've spoken about this issue again and again is even if you think it's impossible, that is irrelevant. Irrelevant. I spoke at Dartmouth once, and a woman stood up after I spoke, right in my book, and she said to me, "Professor, you've convinced me. This is hopeless. Hopeless. There's nothing we can do." When she said that, I scrambled. I tried to think, how do I respond to that hopelessness? What is that sense of hopelessness? And what hit me was an image of my 6-year-old son. And I imagined a doctor coming to me and saying, Your son has terminal brain cancer, and there's nothing you can do. Nothing you can do. So, would I do nothing? I just sit there, accept that? Okay, nothing I can do. I'm going off to build Google Glass. Of course not. I would do everything I could, and I would do everything I could because this is what love means, that the odds are irrelevant, and that you do whatever the hell you can, the odds be damned. And then I saw the obvious link, because even we liberals love this country. And so when the pundits and the politicians say that change is impossible, what this love of country says back is that's just irrelevant. we lose something dear, something everyone in this room loves and cherishes, if we lose this republic. And so we act with everything we can to prove these pundits wrong. So here's my question. Do you have that love? Do you have that love? Because if you do, then what the hell are you? What the hell are we doing? When Ben Franklin was carried from the Constitutional Convention in September of 1787, he was stopped in the street by a woman who said, "Mr. Franklin, what have you wrought?" Franklin said, "A republic, madam. If you can keep it, a republic, a representative democracy, a government dependent upon the people alone." We have lost that republic. All of us have to act to get it back. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That's how we traveled in the year 1900. That's an open buggy. It doesn't have heating. It doesn't have air conditioning. That horse is pulling it along at 1% of the speed of sound. And that rutted dirt road turns into a quagmire of mud anytime it rains. That's a Boeing 707. Only 60 years later, it travels at 80% of the speed of sound. And we don't travel any faster today because commercial supersonic air travel turned out to be a bust. So I started wondering and pondering, could it be that the best years of American economic growth is behind us? And that leads to the suggestion, maybe economic growth is almost over. Some of the reasons for this are not really very controversial. There are four headwinds that are just hitting the American economy in the face. They're demographics, education, debt, and inequality. They're powerful enough to cut growth in half. So we need a lot of innovation to offset this decline. And here's my theme. Because of the headwinds, if innovation continues to be as powerful as it has been in the last 150 years, growth is cut in half. If innovation is less powerful, invents less great, wonderful things, then growth is going to be even lower than half of history. Now here's 8 centuries of economic growth. The vertical axis is just percent per year growth. 0% a year, 1% a year, 2% a year. The white line is for the UK, and then the US takes over as the leading nation in the year 1900 when the line switches to red. You'll notice that for the first 4 centuries, there's hardly any growth at all, just 0.2%. Then growth gets better and better. It maxes out in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and then it starts slowing down. And here's a cautionary note. That last downward notch in the red line is not actual data. That is a forecast that I made 6 years ago, that growth would slow down to 1.3%. But you know what the actual facts are? You know what the growth in per-person income has been in the United States in the last 6 years? Negative. This led to a fantasy. What if I try to fit a curved line to this historical record? I can make the curved line anywhere I wanted, end anywhere I wanted, but I decided I would end it at 0.2, just like the UK growth for the first 4 centuries. Now, the history that we've achieved is that we've grown at 2.0% per year over the whole period 1891 to 2007. And remember, it's been a little bit negative since 2007. But if growth slows down, instead of doubling our standard of living every generation, Americans in the future can't expect to be twice as well off as their parents, or even a quarter as well off as their parents. Now we're going to change and look at the level of per capita income. The vertical axis now is thousands of dollars in today's prices. You'll notice that in 1891, over on the left, we were at about $5,000. Today, we're at about $44,000 of total output per member of the population. Now, what if we could achieve that historic 2% growth for the next 70 years? Well, it's a matter of arithmetic. 2% growth quadruples your standard of living in 70 years. That means we'd go from 44,000 to 180,000. But we're not going to do that, and the reason is the headwinds. The first headwind is demographics. It's a truism that your standard of living rises faster than productivity, rises faster than output per hour, if hours per person increased. And we got that gift back in the 70s and 80s when women entered the labor force. But now it's turned around. Now hours per person are shrinking. First, because of the retirement of the baby boomers. And second, because there's been a very significant dropping out of the labor force of prime age adult males who are in the bottom half of the educational distribution. The next headwind is education. We've got problems all over our educational system, despite race to the top. In college, we've got cost inflation in higher education that dwarfs cost inflation in medical care. We have, in higher education, $1 trillion of student debt. And our college completion rate is 15 percentage points below Canada. We have a lot of debt. Our economy grew from 2000 to 2007 on the back of consumers massively overborrowing. Consumers paying off that debt is one of the main reasons why our economic recovery is so sluggish today. And everybody, of course, knows that the federal government debt is growing as a share of GDP at a very rapid rate. And the only way that's going to stop is some combination of faster growth in taxes or slower growth in entitlements, also called transfer payments. And that gets us down from the 1.5 where we reached for education down to 1.3. And then we have inequality. Over the 15 years before the financial crisis, the growth rate of the bottom 99% of the income distribution was half a point slower than the averages we've been talking about before. All the rest went to the top 1%. So that brings us down to 0.8. And that 0.8 is the big challenge. Are we going to grow at 0.8? If so, that's going to require that our inventions are as important as the ones that happened over the last 150 years. So let's see what some of those inventions were. If you wanted to read in 1875 at night, you needed to have an oil or a gas lamp. They created pollution, they created odors, they were hard to control, the light was dim, and they were a fire hazard. By 1929, electric light was everywhere. We had the vertical city, the invention of the elevator. Central Manhattan became possible. And then, in addition to that, at the same time, hand tools were replaced by massive electric tools and hand-powered electric tools, all achieved by electricity. Electricity was also very helpful in liberating women. Women, back in the late 19th century, spent 2 days a week doing laundry. They did it on a scrub board. Then they had to hang the clothes out to dry. Then they had to bring them in. The whole thing took 2 days out of the 7-day week. And then we had the electric washing machine. And by 1950, they were everywhere. But the women still had to shop every day. But no, they didn't, because electricity brought us the electric refrigerator. Back in the late 19th century, the only source of heat in most homes was a big fireplace in the kitchen that was used for cooking and heating. The bedrooms were cold. They were unheated. But by 1929, certainly by 1950, we had central heating everywhere. What about the internal combustion engine, which was invented in 1879? In America, before the motor vehicle, transportation depended entirely on the urban horse, which dropped without restraint 25 to 50 pounds of manure on the streets every day, together with a gallon of urine that comes out at 5 to 10 tons daily per square mile in cities. Those horses also ate up fully one quarter of American agricultural land. That's the percentage of American agricultural land that took to feed the horses. Of course, when the motor vehicle was invented, and it became almost ubiquitous by 1929, that agricultural land could be used for human consumption or for export. And here's an interesting ratio. Starting from zero in 1900, only 30 years later, the ratio of motor vehicles to the number of households in the United States reached 90% in just 30 years. Back before the turn of the century, women had another problem. All the water for cooking, cleaning, and bathing had to be carried in buckets and pails in from the outside. It's a historical fact that in 1885, the average North Carolina housewife walked 148 miles a year carrying 35 tons of water. But by 1929, cities around the country had put in underground water pipes. They had put in underground sewer pipes. And as a result, one of the great scourges of the late 19th century, waterborne diseases like cholera began to disappear. And an amazing fact for techno-optimists is that in the first half of the 20th century, the rate of improvement of life expectancy was three times faster than it was in the second half of the 19th century. So it's a truism that things can't be more than 100% of themselves. And I'll just give you a few examples. We went from 1% to 90% of the speed of sound. Electrification, central heat, ownership of motor cars, they all went from 0 to 100%. Urban environments make people more productive than on the farm. We went from 25% urban to 75% by the early post-war years. What about the electronic revolution? Here's an early computer. It's amazing. The mainframe computer was invented in 1942. By 1960, we had telephone bills, bank statements were being produced by computers. The earliest cell phones, the earliest personal computers, were invented in the 1970s. The 1980s brought us Bill Gates, DOS, ATM machines to replace bank tellers, barcode scanning to cut down on labor in the retail sector. Fast forward through the 90s, we had the dot-com revolution and a temporary rise in productivity growth. But I'm now going to give you an experiment. You have to choose either option A or option B. Option A is you get to keep everything invented up till 10 years ago. So you get Google, you get Amazon, you get Wikipedia, and you get running water and indoor toilets. Or you get everything invented yesterday, including Facebook and your iPhone, but you have to give up, go out to the outhouse, and carry in the water. Hurricane Sandy caused a lot of people to lose the 20th century, maybe for a couple of days, in some cases for more than a week. Electricity, running water, heating, gasoline for their cars, and a charge for their iPhones. The problem we face is that all these great inventions, we have to match them in the future. And my prediction that we're not going to match them brings us down from the original 2% growth down to 0.2, the fanciful curve that I drew you at the beginning. So here we are back to the horse and buggy. I'd like to award an Oscar to the inventors of the 20th century, the people from Alexander Graham Bell to Thomas Edison to the Wright brothers. I'd like to call them all up here, and they're going to call back to you. Your challenge is, can you match what we achieved? Thank you.
Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
Henry Ford Community College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. HFCC was one of only six community college programs studied by Recruiting New Teacher, Inc. and has been the model for other colleges around the nation. For more information about HFCC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
All right, I've gone through all the tracks, just move through the beats. Do your thing.
All right, everyone, let's hear it for West High's own Brooke Turner, a.k.a. DJ Hook.
Scratching up my first school dance takes confidence. So getting into college, I've got what it takes. So do you.
Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org. Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Dad, how do you throw a curveball? How do you build a fort? How do refrigerators run? How do fish learn how to swim?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
How high can you jump?
But you don't have to know every answer.
How many phone numbers are there?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
How do cell phones work?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
What's electricity?
They just need you.
What's the moon made of?
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Good afternoon and welcome to The Best of Broadway. I'm Joey, your host for the next 2 hours, and we have two great plays for you this afternoon. Both of them take place in New York City. Around one is in the year 1933, and the other one is over a period of about 30 years. The first one is what I call the Democratic play. It's called Annie. It's about Little Orphan Annie, and it's about the period of the fall of the stock market, the Depression, and it's very has Franklin D. Roosevelt as a character in play. It's rather not too fond of Herbert Hoover. They blame him with the Depression. But anyway, that's what I call the Democratic play. The other play is Fiorello, the life of Fiorello LaGuardia, a Republican in New York who fought the Tammany Hall machine, the Democratic Tammany Hall machine. So whatever your politics, we got one that you like at least. We're going to start off with Annie, and the story goes like this. By the way, this is WHFR, the station making waves, and we're on 89.3 on your FM dial and WHFR.FM online. Okay, it's December 1933, and America's deep in the midst of a Great Depression. On the Lower East Side of New York, the Municipal Orphanage Girls Annex has been a drab home of 11-year-old Annie, played by Andrea McArdle,